So if you'll open your Bibles to 1 Peter chapter 2. First Peter is a letter of encouragement. And from what we've seen previously, the encouragement that Peter focuses on is telling the Christians that are scattered that they have an inheritance, and that inheritance isn't going anywhere. It's guaranteed. As long as we are obedient, as long as we're living lives dedicated to God, then there's nothing that can disturb or take away that inheritance. He encourages those who are scattered by telling them they're part of a group. We are, it's something that we may not think about a lot, but we are God's chosen people. We are a special group of people. And we're special in that we have Christ's sacrifice that redeems us. And so in chapter 2, we come to a series of exhortations. Peter's not saying, you know, everything is going to be great and wonderful and your life is going to be without any problems. And for us, part of what Peter is addressing is how we should live our lives in the face of these problems. So I want to start out by linking the previous texts to what we're talking about today in terms of our relationships. So I asked in question one, we'll start off with a question. Question one asks, why does Peter tell Christians, or what does Peter tell Christians to do to live good lives? That's a what. According to chapter 2, verses 1 and 2.
So Sam from Blessed West sent me to their behavior excel among the Gentiles.
Why? So he's exhorting them, you know, these are how the Gentiles live. These are how the people who around you live. You know, whether it's Gentiles or whether it's Jews that are among them. The focus is the Gentiles, obviously, because they are much more worldly. But the chapter 2, 1 and 2 is included in the same thought as chapter 1, verses 22 through 25. He uses the concreteness, the endurance, the fact that it's not going anywhere, the word, to encourage us. You know, if God's truth is not going anywhere, what does that imply to us? It implies to us that we need to obey it in order to live good lives. And going through chapter 2, for me, that focus is applied to the relationships that we have to others, because when I read this and try to take a mindset of someone who's being persecuted, then the instinct when you're suffering is to reject the world around you, rebel against it. And this is kind of the theme that he's following in terms of exhortations about the relationships that they have with people that aren't necessarily part of the church. So he starts with government. So question two, I ask, what command does Peter give in verses 13 through 14, and why?
Submit to the king and the government.
And let's remember that in this time, those governments are not friendly to Christians. And it's a reflection of Romans 13, which we'll go look at in a minute. But I want to read 13 through 17 to get the entire idea down in one go. 13 through 17 says, "Therefore submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, which to the king as supreme, or to governors, as to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. As free, yet not using liberty as a cloak for vice, but as bondservants of God, honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king." So, in the face of being persecuted by government, why does Peter tell them to obey government? If you're someone who is living under persecution by the government, what is your instinct? What do you naturally want to do? Let's forget the fact that you're a Christian. If you're just somebody in the world and your government is actively going against you, what do you want to do in response?
Rebel.
Now, is this the command that Peter is giving?
No,
it's not. Which is counterintuitive. You know, for me, it's counterintuitive. I can't say for 100% sure for the Christians, but I would think that for the Christians at that time, it would be a little bit counterintuitive. Why should we listen to a government that is openly against us as Christians? It's the will of God, and Peter gives a good answer to that question. What is the purpose of government according to this passage? Do what? Right. The purpose is to punish evil and to praise the good.
Matt, there's also a thread of thought that you can go back to chapter 1. You know, we should submit to the government because of what God wants us to do. In the text it says, "For such is the will of God that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men." But if you start back in chapter 1, around 13, 14, it says, "As obedient children, do not conform to the former lust, but," in verse 15, "like the Holy One, who calls you to be holy yourselves." And he goes into the attitude that we should have together. You know, they're saved Christians in a time that they're being persecuted, and they are having to deal with these persecutions, these struggles. So here, don't be your former self. You have been saved, so be obedient children. Be like the Holy One. Then he gives application. "Since you have," in verse 22 of chapter 1, "since you have in obedience to the truth purified your souls for a sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart." And then he goes on further in chapter 2, 1, "therefore putting aside all malice." So here's application to that. Application on how we do that. He goes on down in chapter 2, verse 9 and 10. Okay, so now we've had, here's the love of the brother. Now you're a set apart nation. So you're a chosen race. We talked about that last time. So
right.
You're a chosen race. "So I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from the former lust." You're a saved people. You should have love for your brother because you should be like the Holy One. That's what I want you to do. And then remember that you are of me. You are a chosen race. You should set yourself apart. Now here's how we apply that. Submit yourself to the Lord. And then he continues on. Here's how you make application in a time frame where things aren't going so well. Because you are saved, because you should want to be like a little, because you are obedient children, these are the things you should do. You should submit to the government, not only because God's limited power, but it sets you apart from everyone else in a time where, like you said, people would want to rebel against an oppressive nation. That's not what God wants you to do.
Right. So Keith really brought that together, that, you know, this is part of the flow of the letter, that as Christians, Peter's telling them, you are different from the people that are around you. You know, not only do you have the inheritance, but you have this love for each other. You know, the bond that we have as Christians is encouragement in itself. And he calls us to be a people separate, which continues in these relationships. As a unique people, as someone who is different, then your relationship to institutions of the world is going to be different. You shouldn't act like everybody else does. If you don't like government, then you just ignore it and do whatever you want. You know, you're a law unto yourself. Peter says, no, that's not the case. And he gives that reason that God put these institutions in place. He put authorities in place. And the second reason that Keith was pointing out in verse 15, that by doing good, you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. And he's also making sure to correct them, their thinking in terms of their liberty. Part of being a Christian is that we are free from sin. But it's very easy and very tempting. And you see this in quote unquote, you know, denominations, other churches, that the idea, if we're free from sin, then it's okay if we continue in sin. You know, if you think of once saved, always saved, they're not concerned about sin in a continuing sense. But Peter contradicts this idea in verse 16, saying that we're free, but not using our liberty as a cloak for vice, but as bondservants of God. And that mindset is harmonious with other passages in the New Testament. Let's go to Romans chapter 6. You know, this statement is consistent with Romans chapter 6. In Romans chapter 6, in verse 1, you know, he says, shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? Certainly not. How shall we who died to sin live any longer in it? And if we go down to verse 5, he says, for if you have been united together in the likeness of his death, certainly we all shall be in the likeness of his resurrection. Verse 12, he says, do not let sin reign in your mortal body. In verse 15, he focuses on who we submit ourselves to. In this life, we really only have two choices. And the same goes for 1 Peter chapter 2. Who are we going to submit ourselves to? Either it's going to be God's law or it's going to be the law of sin. So Romans 6 is pretty consistent and pretty harmonious with 1 Peter chapter 2. Another passage that's consistent with this is Romans 13. You know, you can't have a conversation about government without going to Romans 13. But one thing that I want to ask is, when we look at Romans 13, what comparison do we see? Are they saying the exact same things? Or what's the difference? In Romans 13, in Verse 1, it says, let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is God's minister and avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Therefore, you must be subject, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience's sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for they are God's ministers, attending continually to this very thing. Render, therefore, to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, and honor to whom honor. So in Romans 13, you know, the letter is to the Romans, and there's a lot more said by Paul in Romans about the function of government and our relationship to government. When we go back to 1 Peter chapter 2, the focus is more on keeping the Christians on track, preventing the Christians from openly going against government.
You said keeping the Christians on track. Verse 12, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, avoiding slander as evildoers. And then it's only like in the same breath, he says the government is for punishing evildoers. And so he's bringing to light a Christian's excellent behavior is being perceived by the outsiders, by the Gentiles, by the world. And following the authorities of the land, the emperor, the governors, that is part of excellent behavior. That's part of how they prevent their Christian walk from being a misrepresentation of what God intends us to live like.
Right. You're right. There's always, it's not prominent, but a point that Peter makes is that you're different. And throughout the letter, he explains how we are expressing that difference. You know, how we are set apart, not only spiritually, but we're set apart in our actions. We're set apart by who we are. And we're under a microscope. You know, as people who aren't part of the world is constantly looking for reasons to call out hypocrisy or reasons to reject God, to reject us as examples of that. So that's the first relationship that Peter talks about, is our relationship to government. The second relationship that he talks about is our relationship to masters. Obviously, we don't have that problem today here. None of us are slaves, but the application for us is as people who are employees, people who work for others. So, going back to 1 Peter, starting in verse 18, I'll go ahead and just ask the question. You know, question 4, what is the command that Peter gives in verse 18?
Submit to masters, good or bad.
And the reason that this is important, as a letter of encouragement, Peter is spending more time explaining or trying to encourage them to endure. You know, it's unconditional, even though the natural instinct is, well, I have a bad master. If I have a bad master, then I don't have to do what they say, or I can reject that master. And he gives a reason, you know, it's unconditional, but does that mean it's hopeless? Verse 19 says that, for this is commendable, if because of conscience toward God, one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. For what credit is it when you're beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. For to this you are called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth. So it's, as Christians, it's not, whenever I read this, if I'm putting myself in someone who is really suffering, then the question that, or the statement that I'm constantly thinking is, this isn't fair. Why is this happening to me? I'm a Christian. I'm doing the right things. Yet I'm going through these trials. I'm going through this suffering. Why am I doing this? And for me, Peter saying that it's commendable is not the strongest encouragement, but it may be for someone else. You know, the Bible is written for so many different people that there are those who out there who can find comfort in this idea that even though we're suffering now, that is commendable to God. That is something that has a silver lining, that has a that's kind of a reward in itself. So, question 5 was already answered. You know, it doesn't depend on whether the master is good or bad to you. And chapter 2 is, this is kind of a little bit off the beaten path, but chapter 2 is very parallel, or is the entire chapter is a very good example of the harmony between what Peter's written and what Paul has written. There's a lot of people who today reject or want to dismiss Paul's writings. You know, but if we go back to Romans, as we saw in the example of government, and we can also go to Ephesians chapter 6. So if anyone says, you know, Paul wrote this and it's not something that I do, I don't think that Paul is an inspired writer, it's not something that any of us would say, but it is something that I've heard people in other, you know, people in denominations will say that. Well, that was Paul's writing. And if you want a way to say, well, no, listen, Paul's writing is consistent with Peter's writing. 1 Peter chapter 2, you start with government. Okay, here's a passage on government. Romans 13 says the same thing. Here's a passage on masters and slaves. You go back to Ephesians 6, 5-8. And it is consistent. It is harmonious, even though it's two different authors. In 5-8, it says, "Bondservants, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in sincerity of heart, as to Christ. Not with eye service as men pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart. With good will, doing service as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same from the Lord, whether he's slave or free." Now, there's some subtle difference there, right? in Ephesians, the focus is not on if you have a good or a bad master. The focus is on the attitude that the Christian should have toward their master. In 1 Peter chapter 2, you know, but they still say the same thing, that as servants, we are to obey our masters. And of course, in our sense, that would be anyone who has authority over us. But in 1 Peter chapter 2, the focus is more on, well, if you have a bad master, this is how to deal with it. Find comfort in understanding that your suffering is to your credit. And in verse 21, he says that, for to this you are called because Christ also suffered for us. And you may look at that and say, you know, that's very discouraging. Is the point of my life just to suffer? Is part of the calling just to endure this life? And I'd say that would be kind of a superficial understanding. You know, there is more to the calling, and that's something that Peter continues to point out through the book. There's more to the calling than suffering. And using Christ as an example, Christ didn't just come to this earth to suffer. That wasn't the point of his existence. And that's not the point of the Christian's existence that this letter is written to. The point is not suffering. The point is doing God's will. The point is spreading the gospel. You know, we're not called to suffer. You're not. Peter didn't say, Matt, I want you to be alive so that you can go through all this pain and torture. God's calling us to be his ambassadors on earth. Part of that is going through trials, but part of that is service. Part of that is hope. You know, we have confidence. If you think about people who are not Christians, what hope do they have? You know, what comfort can they find in the next life? There's nothing to hope for. Whereas the Christian has hope. We have confidence that after this life, we will live in glory, that we will be with God in heaven. And that's a comforting thought. We don't have to live in fear in this life of the next, which is something that the rest of the world doesn't have. So I'd say that's part of the calling as well. And Peter is wrapping this up with what Christ did for us. You know, he's encouraging them by pointing out the example of Christ, that we're not the first ones to suffer, and that our suffering is not unique. It's something that Christ went through as well. You know, verse 23 says that when he, Christ, was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously, who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes you are healed. For you were like sheep gone astray, but having now returned to the shepherd, overseer of your souls. So Peter doesn't just leave them hanging. He doesn't just say, you know, endure life, endure being a slave. But he says, look, you're not the only one that's gone through this. And that's an encouragement. Knowing that we're not alone in what we go through in this life is something that gives us some hope, gives us some motivation and encouragement. Rocky.
Matt, on this point you're making about calling for this purpose, I think you were saying you were called for the purpose of suffering. Back up to verse 20, there's actually another thing there. You recall, he says, when you do right, you suffer for it patiently. Another way to look at this thing is the purpose we were really called for is to do what is right. And if you don't do what is right, you're going to suffer. And the example of Christ, he did the will of God. And as a result of that, you know, he suffered for to follow his footsteps. So you might add to that that we were called to do what is right, and in the process of doing what is right, we will suffer.
Yeah, so we're called to do right. And yeah, we're called to do right. I'll go with that. You're right. Josh.
Christ cared about people's souls while he was on earth. He did perform some miracles and healed and fed. But if his purpose was to give everybody all the comforts in life, that's what he would have purposed to do while he was on earth. That wasn't his purpose. It was the salvation of people's souls. And what being talked about here with the governors, the emperor, unfair masters, is our purpose to rebel or be rebel-rousers so that we can obtain comforts in life? Or is our purpose to be a light, a follower of God, living like Christ did? That's our purpose. And it's not to, you know, make things best for us in the world from a physical point of view. And it's also not to encourage even outsiders to rebel as we serving as rebel-rousers. That's how we're able to be a light. And we're a light to the world in which we do good things for people and we refrain from, you know, doing evil things or being in the middle of, like, rebelling. The purpose is, like he ended with, God is the shepherd and guardian of our souls. It's not about trying to achieve the best comfort or status or wealth in life. It's really the opposite. It's about souls, and oftentimes that results in the opposite of wealth and comfort.
Yeah, it's easy to get caught up in, you know, I need to earn a dollar so I can buy an apple so I can eat. But God's focus throughout the New Testament, and God's focus here and what Peter writes about, is that we need to focus on the spiritual. You know, he is the overseer of our souls. And he said that he would provide for us. It doesn't mean that he's going to provide a mansion, a physical mansion, but he provides a spiritual mansion. You know, a mansion in heaven. To some people may not think that's good enough. They may say that, you know, I want to be physically comfortable here on earth. And that's part of Peter's writing here, is that that may or may not happen, with the focus on that's not going to happen, that you're going through these trials, but you're going through them for a purpose. And the way that you handle these trials is part of being a light in the world, as Josh was talking about. When we rise to the occasion, when we suffer persecution from government or suffer persecution from masters, other people are going to see that, and they're going to see our response to that. And that response, it may not convince everyone every time, but it is something that can convince other people in the world. Here's this guy, here's this woman, and they are enduring this. You know, that is something that is remarkable, and that would may lead them to say, "Who is this person? Where does their strength come from?" Which would lead them to the Word. So that's also part of the calling, is to be lights unto the world. Yes, Annas.
Serve here, you know, if we're concerned about punishments, problems we have, and it's all me, self-serving. But we're here to serve God. Jesus Christ served God. I mean, with the cross, he didn't bend to God. He was obeying God, doing God's will. And that's what we should be concerned about. Not, you know, oh, I'm suffering, oh, I'm being mistreated, oh, me. You know, they're not serving self, serving God.
Yeah, I think you can. It's you can say that part of this is Peter telling them to be servants. I don't think it's the main point that Peter's trying to make. The main point that Peter's trying to make is explaining to them that they're examples. When you're an example, You are serving. That's kind of baked into the passage. But what does that service look like? How is that service different from the service of other people that are around you who aren't Christians? So question six, we've been talking about it. Someone may say, you know, it's not fair that we're treated badly. And what's Peter's response to that? In verse 21 through 25.
We're called to do right.
We're called to do right. And we have the example of Christ. You know, if someone says this isn't fair, then Peter's response is, well, Christ went through this. So if Christ can go through this, then he is our example of going through this. And Peter continues with the relationship between wives and husbands. So just reading 1 through 6, I asked the question in question 7, what's Peter's general focus on the conduct of wives?
Being in subjection.
Being in subjection? I will agree with that. There's another angle that whenever I asked the question, I had in mind. You are 100% right. Being in subjection is something that Peter tells wives to do.
Do what is right.
Do what is right.
Respectfully.
Right. Peter's, and I hate to say this, but Peter's attitude or Peter's focus is more on the attitude of the wife. You know, he focuses on that with the contrast. In verse 3, he says, don't let your adornment be merely outward. But verse 4, let it be the hidden person of the heart. So, Peter focuses more on the wives' attitude toward their husbands. What kind of husbands are these wives dealing with in this particular passage?
Non-Christian.
Right, non-Christian. And that's implied in verse 1 when he says that even if some do not obey the word, they, wives, without a word, or husbands, is the they, without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives. And this makes sense that Peter's writing this to these Christians who are scattered in different parts of Asia. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of intermarriage. So what does that relationship look like? If I'm married to an unbeliever, then what should I do about that? And Peter says, Peter's focus here is on your example. Is that the same focus that's on the role of husbands in verse 7? Are husbands trying to be good examples for unbelieving wives?
It says in the same way. So an idea of a respectful behavior and treating them in a way that would be pleasing to God, I would say yes.
Well, it's in the same way, and I would argue that the same way is talking about the attitude that we have toward our wives. It not necessarily unbelieving wives. So Peter doesn't say much about it, but
I would say it's more about, like when he talks about treating the weaker vessel, you know, wives being in subjection, yes, and have a submissive attitude, but men, you know, you have a role to play also as a protector and as the guider of the family.
Right. Right. Husbands are husbands have a different focus, whereas the wife's focus is on being an example. The husband's focus is on paying attention to the wife and understanding his wife. And I'll kind of leave it at that. You know, as wives, they're to be submissive to their husbands. As husbands, they're to understand their wives. Well, that's it. It's 15, so...